Okay, my name is Paul Funk with the Agricultural Research Service, Southwestern Cotton Ginning Research Lab, and this is the view from our laboratory of New Mexico State University campus. I'd like to acknowledge New Mexico State University's chemistry and biochemistry department. We've done the work with them, and Cotton Incorporated, who has funded that work. I'll talk about why it's important to detect plastics in seed cotton, and I'll explain how this contraption that we're using, the ion mobility spectrometer, I'll explain how it works, and then the materials, methods, results, and conclusions of the work of the last few months. And I'll end my presentation with a bit of personal advice. And here is the Walmart. I'm sorry, I'm not allowed to say that. I'll get sued. Discount shopping retail type bags that are all over the world now and are choking up cotton fields as well as everything else. When that material gets into the gin, the person operating the gin doesn't have a chance to see it because there's so much cotton going through so quickly. And the same is true at the spinning mill. There's rumors even that some spinning mills turn the lights off when the people go home and leave the machines to run by themselves. So the opportunity to discover contamination only occurs at the very last stage of the production process when all value has been added, and that's the final garment inspection. And a small piece of plastic can ruin the entire garment. This has resulted in claims against spinning mills. Shea Simpson estimated that a couple years ago that it was over $5 million a year. The current method for detecting and removing this is not something we would consider tenable in our society today, but it is practiced in other parts of the world. Because of the automation of the gin, the economy of scale of gins having increased over the years, the amount of cotton that's being processed is 3/4 of a ton a minute, and that's usually going about 68 miles an hour. So it's very hard to see or do something about a contaminant that might be in that seed cotton. It's also being diluted with a lot of air. And finally, the fact that the contamination may be buried inside and not on the surface makes it hard to detect using optical means. It's for these reasons that we chose to use a ion mobility spectrometer. So now I'm going to diverge for a moment and talk about how ion mobility spectrometry works. You form what's called a reactant ion by exposing water molecules that are in air to radiation source. When vapor molecules from your contamination bump into these reactant ions, they form product ions. And all this happens in atmospheric pressure and can happen at atmospheric temperatures, slightly elevated temperatures. This is the equation that's used. It shows you the sample and the ion bumping into each other and associating by knocking a water molecule out of the way. Then these product ions are characterized by their mobility and electric field. And I'm going to use the analogy of skydiving because I kind of like it, and it seems to explain it fairly well. When a skydiver is on an aircraft and the aircraft gains altitude, he increases in his excitement. The thing that keeps the skydiver from experiencing the pull of gravity is the floor of the aircraft. And so until the door opens and lets him into the free air, he can't begin to fall. The same is true with ions in an ion mobility spectrometer. Until the electric shutter opens, the ions are held back from experiencing the pull of the electric field. Just as a skydiver can change his terminal velocity by changing his profile or his wind resistance, so the ions in the electric field have a wind resistance, and that's what separates them and characterizes them. For a molecule that has a large surface area, it's going to have a lower terminal velocity, and it's going to take longer to reach the far end of the drift tube. And finally, skydivers can cluster together just as molecules in a drift tube do, and that can change their terminal velocity as well. When the skydiver touches the ground, you can detect him. When the ion touches the end of the drift tube, an electron is exchanged and the ion is detected. The custom ion mobility spectrometer that we built for this project was a piece of Teflon tubing 3/4 inch in diameter and 2 inches in length. We put some old washers around it, high-tech fancy drift rings around it, and holding each drift ring at a different voltage is what produced the electric field that causes the ions to move to the far end. Now, I talked about the shutter being like the door of the airplane that holds the person back. This is nothing but a small wire, a few of them going across, that's held at a voltage equal to the nearby washers, and that holds the ions to the left. The detector plate at the other end is wired to a current amplifier, and this is what gives the ion mobility spectrometer its power. The amplifier is a 10 to the 10 or 10 to the 11th amplification. That's absolutely incredible. If we were trying to do this with a voltage, we couldn't because the noise would be overwhelming. But amplifying a current gives us a little more freedom. The The reactant region, we put a small foil of radioactive nickel. It had about as much radioactivity in it as the smoke detector at your house would have. And nickel foil, radioactive nickel, puts out high-energy electrons, beta particles, and that's what knocks outer valence electrons out of our water molecules, making the reactant ion. Now, the drift gas was run through a scrubber and all that, and it's very dry, but there's still enough molecules of water in there to make reactant ions. We heated our drift gas to 100 degrees to prevent the condensation of unwanted material in the instrument. Reactant ions that we were looking for in this case were anions, O2 minus H2O. Introducing a small flow of sample gas carried the molecules that we were looking for into the reaction region where they bumped into reactant ions to form product ions. Opening the gate allowed everybody to get onto the racetrack, and then closing the gate there. The gate's only open for the blink of an ant's eye, 300 microseconds, very, very short, 3/10 of a millisecond, about 1% of duty cycle. Okay, now the race is on, and you can see the ions reaching the detector plate. The reactant ions are smaller than the product ions, and so they tend to get there sooner. And then we had product ions arriving at 7.6 milliseconds and 9.2 milliseconds. When the ions touch the detector plate, they exchange an electron and become a neutral particle, and these neutral particles are then swept from the drift tube by the drift gas. We repeated this cycle 20 times a second and averaged 30 spectra together to get rid of some background noise. So in 1.5 seconds, we have a complete average, and in 10 minutes, we have over 400 of these spectra. The typical spectra looks something like this. Here you can see reactant ions. That's the thin line. That's when we had seed cotton in our heating area, and we didn't have any plastic. When we added the plastic, then we got the product ions you see to the right. Materials and methods for the research for the last few months. New Mexico State University's Iceman Group Laboratory has developed some standard instruments over the years, a shutter controller, a high-voltage power supply, and a current amplifier that they use in all of their ion mobility spectrometers. So we just used existing technology for that. We added temperature controllers and a stainless steel cylinder that held the ion mobility spectrometer. The bottom of that stainless steel cylinder was a very large membrane inlet, and the membrane was a silicate that prevented the passage of water molecules into the drift area. We didn't want the water content of the drift gas changing, because that would change the time it took molecules to get from one end of the detector to the other. We set that right over the vent of our drying oven, and we put the samples in the drying oven. We also had mass flow meters to control the flow of gas in there, and National Instruments interface with a computer and National Instruments software running the system. Here you can see seed cotton in the drying oven. The seed cotton was 1 kilogram. And then as soon as the door of the oven is shut, we push the button and start scanning. And then for the contamination, we put 10 grams or less of plastic on top of the seed cotton. And again, shut the door and started scanning. Repeated after the plastic was removed to see how long it took for the signal to dissipate. And repeated and repeated, and put different plastics and different weights of plastics in there. Ended up with lots and lots of hot cotton and melted plastic. The drying oven temperature was just slightly above boiling. This is a temperature that's reasonable, because that's what you might find in a gin drying system. The typical spectra here, and looks like the color's better over there than on the laptop. So you can see the pink curve, that was with the plastic. The white curve, the tallest one on the left, is before we put anything in the oven. Notice that reactant ion peak there, those are the water molecules that have been ionized. It depresses the reactant ion peak, because reactant ions are consumed in forming product ions. The first product ion cluster came at 7.6 milliseconds, and the second at 9.2. And I'm going to zoom in on that 9.2, because this is what gives us hope that we're headed the right direction. Notice that 10 minutes after, and with cotton only, you have about the same response there, even though there's the reactant ion peak never fully rebounds. It does clean itself up right there at 9.2. So that would be where we would have our instrument looking for contamination. Now, I'm happy just right there with that. But there are people out there who review papers that I write, and they want to know, well, what molecules were they? And so this is cotton all alone. What I've done is I've taken the the drift time in milliseconds that was on the x-axis, I've moved it over to the y-axis, and I've made the height of the spectra the color intensity, and put a whole bunch of those curves together. So experiment time is the bottom right bottom axis moving towards the right. This is just cotton alone, and then this is cotton with plastic. And you see there, 9.2 milliseconds, after about 2 minutes, there's this enormous pink spot. That means we're getting a lot of reactant ions consumed by forming product ions there. If we put diethyl phthalate, which is a plasticizer chemical, into the drying oven, we get a response at 9.2 milliseconds. And if we put heptane, which is also something that comes out of thermal decomposition of typical plastics found in cotton contamination, we get a response at 9.2 milliseconds. So my conclusion is that, well, if that's 9.2 milliseconds is where the spot from the plastic contaminant shows up, it's either diethyl phthalate or heptane, or maybe both. We moved our instrument into the gin, and we're not as successful there as we were in the lab, partly because the cotton was zipping by so quickly, the instrument didn't have a chance to see it. So we hope to advance the project by moving into the gin with an instrument that's connected to something that will hold the cotton for a little longer, something like a steady flow that can accumulate cotton for a brief time without the dilution of air. And I promised at the end of my speech that I'd give you a little personal advice. So now that you know how an ion mobility spectrometer works, next time you happen to be at the airport, don't explain that to the TSA employees. They don't have a sense of humor. Thank you for your attention, and this is my email address if you'd like to correspond about this.
We have a few minutes left if anyone has any questions for Paul.
Well, the yellow light is on, so.
That's right.
Okay.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.